In any case, we're joined now live at the library by a very self-aware person. Our food policy, well, sort of self-aware. Food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Comer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Trust Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hi, Corby. Nice
Hello,
to see you.
Hello, Jim. Okay. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello. So apparently we're going to get the Michelin people are scouting out Boston restaurants and possible getting us some stars here. When I look at the restaurants in contention for at least one star, I think Jim's been to every single one of them.
No, that's just,
times.
By the way, that's one right. That's Karabaskin's. Yeah. You don't know.
Right. Nightshade Noodle Bar, you've been there.
I've been there.
You've been there. Astra, you've been there. Okay, you've been to
Sarma, you've been to Oleana. But to get Michelin to come, I don't want to hear about that.
You've been to about 40 of these restaurants, Jim.
It sounds like the way you get Michelin to come to town is you pay them to come.
It's pay to play.
That's unbelievable. I didn't know this.
They hold up the tourist bureaus for a lot of money to contribute because it does bring in revenue. And I'm with Deborah First, who wrote a terrific column in The Globe saying...
Oops, Deborah, I said Karabaskin. Sorry, go ahead.
Saying, why would we want this? Because, you know, what does Michelin know about American cuisine? Not much. And who do they think they are? Because they're just holding up different cities. But the fact is, it sells seats in restaurants. It's important. It's there. It's a guide all the time that people get. And, you know, the restaurants like it. It's good for their self-esteem. So, she's convinced me. I'm for it.
But it seems to me that it creates even a greater divide between the haves and the have-nots, meaning the celebrated, very expensive restaurants are likely to maybe eke out one star, and other fabulous restaurants that aren't quite as elite and effete aren't, and it means more people are going to end up going to the one-star restaurant and the fewer people going to the non-starred restaurant.
So something I can't say enough and will be glad to say when they finally come out with their guide is stars are meaningless. The more stars, the more uncomfortable and unhappy you will be as a diner.
So why do you say it's a good thing? Because it's too stiff.
Oh, because there's this so-called bib gourmand. There are other categories that aren't stars that say, this is good value, this is fun.
Oh, I didn't know that.
This is green and sustainable, so you should support it.
Oh.
There's other things that you want to pay attention to. So all of the places Marjorie was just saying you frequent, they're probably going to be one of the, hey, this is a good place to go, even though it's not worth a star because it's not pompous.
So how does it work? They decide and then they send out a press release or you go to their website? Or
the whole thing is about press release and publicity and sales and holding up the tourist markets. So they send anonymous reviewers, which is like the worst kind of traveling salesman life because you're supposed to be anonymous. They don't pay for a companion. You're not even supposed to have a companion.
Oh.
So it's this weird, lonely life that some people seem to crave, and they keep asking me, how can I be a Michelin judge? Because I want to travel the world and eat. So some people actually enjoy it. They go around, then they come back with their findings. I think it's probably a committee. I don't think it's just one person who's in Boston. They decide what the list is going to be, and then the Michelin publicity machine goes into gear because that's what the tourist bureaus, which pony up for this, are counting on. It's publicity.
Okay. And by the way, so we agree. We learn from the story and from you. It's a pay-to-play to get Michelin, or however you pronounce it, to come to town.
Michelin.
Whatever it is.
Michelin. And,
okay, fine. So do... Is there also pay-to-play in terms of making the list, or is it on the merits, meaning at least the merits of the people eating there? Or
my obligation
do they buy
is
a star?
To say no because they want to be above crutch.
But you can't
I
buy
know
a star.
Of no stories
you don't. Okay.
That you can buy a star. But you can spend a lot of money and be pretentious and pompous and do French-influenced or Nordic-influenced trendy cuisine that might impress the judges and has nothing to do with Boston.
How many Michelin-starred restaurants have you eaten at?
You know, many, but I avoid them. I don't go voluntarily because I tend to think they're overpriced. And to get a 3-star, you have to have a stultifying, way overpriced experience and spend a fortune on, you know, linens and silverware, and it's horrible.
So one last thing. Who's paying for this? Is it a tourist?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's usually the Tourist and Convention Bureau to bring in conventions.
Okay, so this story was a fascinating story. It's in the New York Times. A lot of people are, you know, we have a weight problem in America, so lots of people who can afford it, whose insurance will cover it, are getting these weight loss drugs. And this story is about a guy who's not on a weight loss drug, who really likes to eat. He's a big guy, 6'4", 200 10 pounds. He says he felt kind of weird going out to dinner with all these people that were on these weight loss drugs because nobody was eating anything except for him.
Yeah, they're like little kids who push their food around the plate trying to hide it. But there's a couple of things. The industry is really interested in Ozempic and how it's going to change products.
The restaurant industry.
No, I mean the food industry, the packaged food industry. They're worried. They're terrified that people are going to buy less of their food, but they're finding a way around it, which is to charge high prices for smaller portions.
Oh, God.
And for increasing the protein content of food, because people on Ozempic need protein to an extent. You know, Americans get too much protein. There's a current protein obsession. It's a bro thing. We get too much protein. But Ozempic people do lose muscle, and they do need some protein. They also crave sugary and salty foods less. It's this big change for the better when people go on Ozempic. They also drink less. It improves all kinds of health factors. The big problem is the untold story of Ozempic is more than half of people are off within a year. Huge drop-off rate because of side effects. Like a friend of my spouse's who's on Ozempic, this is very typical, he asked her, so how do you like it? And she's, you know, it's just fine. The side effects, you know, aside from waking up at night a couple times with projectile vomiting, it's fine.
Oh, God.
And so there is terrible gastric distress. There's a lot of vomiting.
Oh.
And people get sick of it, and they don't like it. Plus, you know, they inject themselves. That's a big pain. It's going to get better because there are pills coming out, and the companies are reformulating.
So, Corby, in this story in the New York Times that Marjorie is referencing here, some research analyst says that by 2035, 24 million people in the United States will be on one of these GLP-1 things. That's obviously got to have a huge impact on the restaurant industry, which is in trouble already, no?
Yeah, I don't think people are going to eat out less because they eat out.
But they're going to eat less when they go.
They're going to eat out when they go.
Take it
home.
But
right now, the restaurant portions are way too big anyway. Yeah. And so some of the Ozempic patients are saying, oh, this is great because I've got a meal for a week. So
exactly.
Bring it home. And also some of the diners say, I look for friends on Ozempic because I want more food. I'll just eat what's on their plate.
Yeah.
Why
no,
hadn't
I think
I
that's
thought
the
of
thing.
That
they
is
are
brilliant,
huge. I
actually.
Mean, half the time you don't finish what's on
that.
Your plate. And then you do eat for another day or two.
Anybody on Ozempic out of here that wants to have dinner? No. Okay.
No one's raising their hands.
They're not admitting it.
That is brilliant, though. That really is. You got to dinner with someone on Ozempic. And you're
but you
like
have to get
set.
Them to fess up because there were another two diners who said, we went out for a business breakfast. We were sort of pushing it around, and then we revealed.
Yeah.
We're both on Ozempic.
You know, it used to be that that was a sign of someone that has some kind of eating disorder because I've had friends who had anorexia, and they would push their food around on the plate so that it looked like they were eating when they weren't. But now it's a whole new thing. But they suggest in the story that what you do to avoid this is to go do family style or small plates. And that way...
So it is obvious that Kizima don't offend the restaurateur
they're afraid of the chef will think they didn't like the food.
I just have to tell you that restaurateurs... I arrange lots of dinners for my program at Aspen Institute. And restaurants hate family style.
They do?
Because they have less portion control. So even though people might take less, they have to put more food out.
Oh, that's a good
point.
They
don't like it, and they resist it, you know, tooth and nail.
Well, we're going to talk to listeners in a little while about supposedly the age of the fried chicken sandwich. Apparently it's a mania now. And we're going to compare cheeseburgers because
Whether you're a cheeseburger or a fried chicken sandwich kind of person.
So in preparation for that, let's talk a little bit about how chefs really don't like serving cheeseburgers in their restaurants and because they're not making enough money.
Yeah, they're labor intensive. And for a while in the early 2000s, ushered in by Daniel Boulou at DBGB, I remember when he started putting foie gras, your favorite thing to pronounce, middle of burgers. And it was, I think, $34 in the early 2000s.
It wow.
cost a fortune. But it made that restaurant. Everybody came because they had to have the burger. And there's this restaurant, there's a guy named Jeremy Fox, who's a terrific Los Angeles chef, who's quoted in the Times story as, hate burgers. But everybody came in, 70% of my orders were this famous burger he had. And the irony is, Jeremy Fox made his reputation on all plant-based food.
Oh.
So when I read about this, he had Ubuntu and Rustic Canyon, where he broke down and have this burger that, you know, took over Los Angeles. And he started weaning people away from it. I think he was the one who had an 8-seat bar. You had to be at the bar to get one burger, but then he would do this long tasting menu and serve a mini slider in the middle of it so you could taste it. So Crave burgers. Other chefs, it's labor intensive and low profit margin, so they don't want it, but it really takes over menus.
By the way, when I go to a high quality restaurant and I want a cheese, I was just going to mention Craig on Main. I'll get to them in 1 second, which isn't there, unfortunately.
No.
Tony Moore is a brilliant chef,
right,
great person. I often feel guilty, actually, for the reason you mentioned. If you're going to a restaurant that's higher end and the average price is X and you're getting a cheeseburger, which is half X, you feel you're like sort of screwing them. So what Tony Moss did, which is a variation on the theme, when he ran Craigie on Main, which was one of the best restaurants ever on Main Street in Cambridge, is there only a limited number of cheeseburgers. And it was a first come, first serve. The best I've ever had, by the way, were there. I think you had to eat them at the bar. So we weren't denying the customer a cheeseburger. But if you didn't get there early, you were told, sorry, they all left. You didn't feel quite so guilty. So isn't that the perfect splitting of the baby? Have a limited number so you don't screw your business, but at the same time, make your customers happy. If they really want them, go early and get them. Yes?
You know what I'm really wondering is, why didn't he just charge $10 more a burger? Why didn't he make it at a parity with the other entrees? Because you, Jim, and I think anybody who loves burgers would be willing to pay
for a top... I don't know about that. I'm usually willing, because as you know, and Marjorie really knows, there's nothing I enjoy more for fun than going to a good restaurant. I mean, it just really brings me great joy, not just the food. But if the average price is high end and it's like in the 30s and a cheeseburger's in the 30s, you don't think people are going to hesitate to say that's just not right?
But it works for everybody.
And
if
you get
they
French
feel
fries.
Like paying for it, they can get it, and the chef makes the same amount of money.
Okay, so why is this the golden age of the fried chicken
Well,
sandwich?
By the way, we should say, before it's the golden age of fried chicken, what we were shocked to learn is it is the opposite of the golden age of the cheeseburger.
I know.
It is actually declining
I'm
in popularity.
Stunned.
But why is it the golden age of the fried chicken sandwich?
Because people love it, and Chick-fil-A started it, and, you know... Remember when Krispy Kreme was the donut everybody would line up for?
Yeah, very briefly.
Somehow, Chick-fil-A did that with its fried chicken sandwich. So people loved the idea of no bones, easy way to consume it, and importantly, consume in car.
Yeah.
So you could go through a drive-thru and you could have it in the car. So are you now thinking, why haven't I had a fried chicken sandwich?
No, I've had quite a few fried
chicken
sandwiches.
In cars?
Not in a car. That is correct.
What is the deal with Chick-fil-A? Tom Menino didn't want them in the city because he said they were anti-gay LGBTQ stuff. Now, have they reformed themselves or not?
They say they have.
They say they have. That's all I know, that they say they have.
Okay. Yeah. Are we suspicious?
You know, we're always suspicious, but they're also sort of clean, very popular places. And one of my Food Leaders fellows, we were in Starkville, Mississippi, my Food Leader fellowship. Starkville, Mississippi.
Wow.
Home of Mississippi State University, because one seventh-generation black farmer, one zillionth-generation white farmer, both did their PhDs there. At the same time, they met at our fellowship. Our other fellows decided we have to go to Starkville, Mississippi. But she went at an airport stop to Chick-fil-A, and I said, there's not some other interesting restaurants in this concourse. Why are you doing that? And she said, why should I pay money for something I'm not sure is going to taste good? Somehow Chick-fil-A has this kind of loyalty.
Well, let me just say what shouldn't have loyalty. I don't mind bad-mouthing them because it's not a small independent. I have. And answer your question, I said, have you ever eaten a fried chicken sandwich in the car? The answer is I have, but it's not really a fried chicken sandwich, even though it's advertised. It is the McChicken at McDonald's that is practically inedible.
Oh,
let me repeat.
It is.
Practically. The kind of thing that they're talking about here is real restaurants, not just some of the better fast food places. Fried chicken has become like a state, particularly in a lot of Asian restaurants, which sort of surprised me. And the other thing that surprised me, I assume people were switching from beef to chicken because it's healthier, which it is. But if you fry it, it's no healthier than a cheeseburger, right?
Don't tell all the people who are switching from beef. But, you know, if they're the real reason to switch from beef is for the environment, methane emissions. Maybe that's the reason, and that's going to help. Not so much for animal welfare. And Korean fried chicken is it. So I think Korean is where the action is, and that's what people should be, you know, buying and going out and tasting.
So when you go to a Korean restaurant, go for the fried chicken?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
By the way, when at 1:30, when we ask you, are you in the cheeseburger or the fried chicken sandwich mold, we're not only going to ask you to choose, we're also going to ask you to make a recommendation as to which restaurant has the best of the thing that you prefer. So get ready for that at 1:30.
Deborah first did a whole went around to about 15 different fried chicken restaurants.
Yeah.
To find out which.
But you know what the problem is? I couldn't find the names of any of the restaurants in the printout.
I'm trying to figure it out now.
You can't do that either.
It's kind of a little bit confusing the way it's laid out. But that's
so let me ask you a question, Corby. I think you're a world traveler. If you were from Melbourne, Australia, would you listen to our show?
Voluntarily.
Okay. Is Lindsay here from Melbourne, Australia? Where is Lindsay? Did she leave already? Oh, no. She's gone?
Oh.
Oh, well, that's the end of you, Lindsay. I was going to celebrate Lindsay from Melbourne, Australia, who discovered the show a few years ago and thought the show would help him sleep, but it hasn't. And in any case, maybe he's asleep now. In any case, before you go, Corby Cummer, RFK Jr., one of our faves in the federal government, is switching from artificial food dyes to natural food dyes. I assume there'd be celebration even among those who don't celebrate RFK Jr. For other reasons, including have his grandchildren swim with him in a sewer-infested body
yeah,
of water
was
in
really
Washington.
Weird.
Are natural dyes better than what he wants to eliminate?
I'm looking at you blankly because my idea is who cares about dyes?
We shouldn't care.
We shouldn't care.
If you are worried about it, I mean, there's lots of synthetic things. I think they're perfectly safe. I think the new natural dyes are maybe even better and safer. But what I really care about is getting more people more food, and the Republicans last night and this morning are trying to slash SNAP, force states to pay money they don't have for the first time against it.
Extensive
all
work
the
requirements. Yeah.
Extending the age, extending the requirements. So artificial food dyes don't cause the obesity crisis. They don't force type 2 diabetes and 77.5 billion extra a year diet-related chronic diseases. So it's perfectly fine. Another thing, though, is that these natural food colorings that the FDA is approving, there's three of them. You know, that's fine if you don't want synthetic chemicals. But they haven't been tested that long. It's only a guess, FDA is saying, because the studies aren't sufficiently long-term to
okay,
say.
Okay, forget dyes.
So RFK is wrong about that, too, then?
No, well, maybe. But can I get back
so
to this?
So far, they're safe.
Since you're a world traveler, obviously the person from Australia, Lindsay, left.
She left.
It turns out he. Zelda, who is from New Zealand, was also here. She left.
Oh.
So my question for you as a world traveler, do people from New Zealand and Australia only like one-hour radio shows? Is that what the problem is? Or what is it in your travels?
They don't know the quality of your radio.
The second and third hour really pick up incredibly.
They talk fast. I think they talk fast in New Zealand and Australia.
No, they don't talk fast. They just don't know how good you are. And so you have to popularize yourself in New Zealand. However, I have numerous friends going to New Zealand soon.
You do?
I'm going to tell them. Yeah, and whenever I'm traveling, I want you should know, I listen to your show. Yeah.
Why are your friends going to New Zealand?
I'm not on it. Sorry?
Why are your friends going to New Zealand?
Good question, Margaret.
Oh, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What are you doing exactly?
I'm tearing off reviews of the different chicken sandwiches.
You are?
I'm trying to be on top of the situation. Yeah.
Getting ready
while
for 1:30.
While we're talking to Corby, is that what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm doing that. Yeah, I want to be sure I know what's what.
Okay, you know we have a little break here. Maybe you could do it during the pledge
break. Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, that's how it works.
You know,
the clock counts down, and then you take a break,
okay.
And then you come back
later.
Sorry,
Corby. I hope you didn't mind my tearing up pages over here.
Pete Buttigieg grew a beard. Look at Pete Buttigieg. He looks really good,
lots of people like him. We've been speaking with food policy analysts. They do.
Talk
about a great talker.
Of all the enthusiastic crowds we've ever had at the library,
been right here.
That's in the top two or three when he was with us a few years
ago.
That's
right.
If he'd had a beard.
Exactly. And if they had been from New Zealand, he would have left. Okay. We're done here. Nice to see you.
We've been speaking with food policy analyst and multiple James Beard winner, Corby Cummer. I apologize for tearing up the papers. He's executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Thank you very much, Corby.